The Irish Times Inside Business podcast in association with Davy. It's amazing what you discover when you really listen.
Hello and welcome to Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock, a podcast from the Irish Times. This week I'm looking at the future of the Irish economy. On Tuesday, the European Commission forecast that Irish GDP would shrink by 8.5% this year, while the OECD warned that the number of people employed in the state could fall by as much as 8.2% if there were to be a second COVID-19 outbreak. That's the equivalent of 170,000 jobs. And earlier today, the IDA said the level of multinational investment in Ireland could fall this year by as much as 40%. These mirror similarly bleak assessments by the central bank, the ESRI, and the government itself, which has said the budget deficit this year could run to as much as 30 billion euro. So while not a surprise in the context of COVID-19, the forecasts are nonetheless quite shocking. So can the Irish economy be successfully rebooted? What should the new coalition government put in its planned July economic stimulus? Can we afford to keep borrowing on international markets to subsidise businesses and workers? And what about a no-deal Brexit? It hasn't gone away, you know. To tease out these issues and more, I'm joined on the line by economist and Irish Times columnist Chris Johns and by Eoin Burke Kennedy of the Irish Times. Now, you're both very welcome, gentlemen. Chris Johns, I might start with you. The European Commission yesterday predicting that Ireland's economy would shrink by about 8.5% this year. Pretty bleak outlook right across the European Union. The forecast actually much worse than it had anticipated earlier in the year. Does 8.5% shrinkage in the Irish economy, does that sound about right to you?
At the moment it does, yes. I think, but it's important to stress that these forecasts are changing very rapidly. The Commission has called it, I think, an interim summer forecast to contrast it with its spring forecast of only a couple of months ago. And of course, all of its numbers for most countries, including Ireland, have been revised down. The forecasts are worse than before. And forecasting at the best of times is fraught with difficulties. And I think that it's, for obvious reasons, particularly difficult at the moment. The Commission did stress that there are considerable downside risks to these numbers. It obviously feels that the risk is skewed in one direction rather than the other. The forecasts are based on an assumption of no second wave, which of course is a huge assumption and one that we all hope that comes true. The Commission was also at pains to point out that apart from the COVID risks, that Ireland's economic outlook is going to be affected by, as you well know, between the future relationship between the EU and the UK. We keep calling it Brexit, but Brexit's already happened. It's now about the relationship. And it also emphasises the other favourite that we like to talk about is the international taxation environment and what the multinationals get up to here in the wake of those developments. So there's a lot of talk about risks, not much chat about opportunity.
Yeah, sure. And the IDA had a briefing this morning and they predicted that multinational investment in Ireland could be reduced this year by as much as 40%, which is, a huge number that we could never have envisaged pre-COVID.
No, those sorts of numbers would never have been factored into anybody's forecasts. It's inevitable that the numbers are going to be big. So that's for things like FDI. If you're sitting in a big company at the moment, the most natural thing to do is nothing. And so even if you do end up investing in Ireland, it's going to be pushed out. Hopefully that's what this is all about, is that this is investment that's going to come eventually, and we're just talking about timing issues. But if it's investment that never comes, then obviously that has a permanent effect.
Yeah, now, Chris, I know you spend time in Dublin and in London as well. So how do you think Ireland has coped with the COVID crisis so far compared to, let's say, the UK?
Much better. I think that's a very easy call, very easy answer to make, quite actually. I'm chuckling, but it's more a hysterical chuckle than an amused one. It's been an end-to-end mess up in the UK from the biggest thing that they did wrong, of course, was lockdown too late. And the capacity of the state to manage through this very complex issue has been fundamentally called into question in the UK. Yes, there were similar issues in Ireland, but here we seem to have gotten our arms around them much quicker and much better than in the UK. Both countries had a problem with care homes. The one in the UK appears to have been catastrophic. Lots of other issues to do with testing and tracing. Ireland has got an app now. The UK promised one months ago and still doesn't have one that works. The list goes on, but Ireland's done an awful lot better than the UK.
Umber Kennedy, you've been following the Exchequer numbers all year, and I suppose we started out the year in a very good position in January and February, and then suddenly, wallop, the pandemic hit and everything changed. Just walk us through some of the headline numbers and just how bad the Exchequer figures are for the government at the minute.
Yeah, well, I suppose the best starting point when looking at the Exchequer numbers is the deficit at the moment, and that has swelled to about 5.3 billion in June. That's just the difference between what the government spends and what it takes in taxes. Now, just to put that in perspective, this time last year, we had a surplus of 260 million. So we've gone down about over 5 billion. And the bulk of that deterioration is being led by spending, as you might expect, on the two government wage support schemes. So they've pushed us into a sort of deficit figure for June. And that's likely to get much worse because those schemes are going to be in place for some months to come. Now, it wasn't all bad. As usual, corporation tax, the great gift that just keeps on giving, came in way ahead of what the government thought they were going to get. And I suppose your listeners are kind of used to hearing that, but this time it came in 1.9 billion, 48% ahead of target. So that cushioned the blow a little bit for us. Then the main tax head, income tax, came in, this is I'm talking about now for 6 months, came in around 10.6 billion, which was actually probably the most eye-catching and probably the big plus. It was much stronger than most people thought. And the government revised their targets, you know, when the pandemic first hit back in March. So they were even expecting, even in a revised way, much less than this. So it seems that income tax has held up much better than anybody expected. And there's reasons for this. It's likely that, well, for a start, a lot of workers who aren't working are on the government's wage subsidy scheme, and that means they're still paying tax. But the bulk of the workers that have been hit by the lockdown have been in consumer-facing industries, in the hospitality one in particular, and in retail. And a lot of those workers aren't highly paid, and therefore they're not paying a lot of tax. So on that front, income tax has held up pretty well. The place where we're probably going to be hit hardest is in VAT, because that reflects consumer activity, which has been severely curtailed. So in the 6 months so far, we're about 20% down, 1.5 billion down on what we might have expected to have. And that's probably going to get worse in the coming months.
Now, when we have a new coalition government in place comprising Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Green Party, and the programme for government, at least on paper, is quite an ambitious one in terms of what they want to do. And they're talking about a July stimulus plan. Have we any sense of what's likely to be in that economic plan?
Yeah, they've been quite tight-lipped about what's going to be in the plan. And the programme for government was, you know, very aspirational and very light on numbers. But the indications we're getting from government at the moment is that it's going to do two things. It's going to basically be directed at trying to repair the balance sheets of SMEs, which is the big eyesore in how we're dealing with the pandemic at the moment. And the second thing it's going to do is it's going to give us clarity on where the two government income support schemes are going. So the government is trying to get people, I suppose, off the pandemic unemployment payment and onto the wage subsidy scheme. That's the hope. At the moment, the numbers still on the pandemic unemployment payment are still quite high and surprisingly high. I think the government thought that, you know, a lot of people would be coming off that, but it seems businesses are still wary of the level of demand out there. And of course, our lockdown, maybe in, you know, business lobby group terms, has gone on longer and has been more restrictive than ones in other countries. So at the moment, it's a very kind of tender consumer environment. But the two things we should get from that stimulus package is just clarity on these wage subsidy schemes and something more for SMEs.
Right. Chris, the wage subsidy scheme is due to run out at the end of August. I think everybody expects it to be extended. And in fact, I think it's going to go on in the UK until October, if I'm not mistaken. But I'm just wondering, are these affordable for the government going forward? We're able to borrow on international markets at very low rates at the minute, but how long will that continue?
How long is a piece of string? It depends in large part how long the ECB keeps, let's call a spade here, funding the Irish government. We can talk about quantitative easing in its various forms. We can start using lots of jargon. We can start talking about helicopter money and all those other buzz phrases, buzzwords that we know and love. But what's actually happening is that we're able to borrow at next to no cost because the ECB is printing the money. That's what's happening. And for as long as it does that, we can do this. Now, obviously, there has to be a limit to that somewhere. The German Constitutional Court has tried to define that limit, and it looks like it's failed on recent developments. So it's clearly going to continue for a while. How much longer? It's going to have to be until this virus is sorted, either through it magically disappearing, or more likely vaccine or other medical interventions are finally found. So we hope that sooner rather than later. But if the ECB were to stop doing this, stop funding the Irish and indeed all the other members of the Euro governments, we would be in a lot of trouble. I suspect our interest rates would then start to rise and it could get very problematic very quickly. I expect them to keep printing the money, actually. I think that it is likely to continue for the foreseeable future until this virus is dealt with. So there's going to be a legacy of an enormous debt pile, but a huge chunk of it is actually going to be held by the ECB, which creates a very interesting dynamic for thinking about the future. On the wage schemes, in the UK, I think Sunak, the British Chancellor, has just announced that they're going to try and wind down their furlough scheme by the end of October. And he's come up with all sorts of whiz-bang announcements today, as we've been speaking, actually. One of them is to encourage furloughed workers to be rehired. Every one of those, £1,000 will be given to the employer that brings back a furloughed worker. And that's a multi-billion package in and of itself. He's announced a cut in stamp duty to try and give the housing market a lift. He's announced measures, a subsidy, if you like, a gift to diners in restaurants and takeaways of up to £10 a person over the next few months to try and encourage people to go out and spend. That speaks to the demand problem that you mentioned. So the British, certainly in their July statement, we've got one coming, the British have had theirs today, are frankly throwing everything at it.
Yeah, in a recent column in the Irish Times, actually, your advice to the Irish government was spend, spend, spend and spend some more. What do you think they should put in the July stimulus?
Well, I think it's an interesting template what Sunak is doing, because it's so not what a lot of orthodox economics would suggest, like the cut in stamp duty, for example. One I suggest that just as here, the UK has a housing supply problem, not a housing demand problem. But these are very, very strange times. And I think that we are going to have to take risks that we wouldn't have taken in more normal circumstances. And I know that, increasing the demand for housing goes against most orthodox economic advice. But at these peculiar times, I think it's probably the right thing to do to err on that side of the risk spectrum. I think spending I think the belief that I would take out of Sunak's book if I was the Irish government is not necessarily to copy the measures, look at them and see if any of them make individual sense. I'm not sure encouraging people to go into restaurants is actually a good idea from a health perspective, and that's a different discussion. But you've got to keep the demand side of the economy going, otherwise the supply side will eventually collapse. So yeah, have a look at that. But I think I take on board from what Sunak has done, the single most important principle is that he's throwing everything that he's got at it and erring on the side of taking more rather than less monetary risk. And I think that's the right model.
Owen, opening up the economy and the timing of all of that, I mean, it's open to criticism, I guess, and the government was definitely getting it in the neck in the early days that they weren't opening up quickly enough. They accelerated the programme, the roadmap for reopening the economy, and now suddenly we've had some issues around pubs and people congregating outside certain pubs in Dublin City, for example. And now they're talking about possibly not allowing pubs to reopen on July 20th, and they might slow down the reopening of some parts of the economy. So how has Ireland fared, I wonder, against other countries in terms of reopening the economy? Are we going too slow? Are we moving too fast? What's your view?
Well, it sort of depends on your perspective. The business lobby groups here say that we're around 6 weeks behind continental Europe, and they're touting this kind of Google mobility data, which kind of tracks consumers and people as they move around the city and they move into various different retail zones. So they say we're around 6 weeks behind the rest of Europe. And they then give examples of kind of Germany, the Netherlands seem to be ahead of the posse. The Nordics seem to be a little bit behind. The government now would respond and by saying, well, you know, it's better to have people coming back out into a very safe, secure environment where consumer activity then will be kind of more likely to return back to normal levels, where if they come out too soon and there's a mini flare-up or a resurgence of the disease, then people will be doubly scared and maybe not likely to come out for months on end. So it's a very delicate balance and a delicate process. We've got large parts of the workforce and the economy on life support, and transitioning back to that kind of normal phase, whichever it is going to be difficult. That Google mobility data tells us that activity is around 30% behind where it was in January and February. Best case scenario in kind of Germany and the Netherlands, it's about 10% down. So that's kind of where we are. We're definitely behind the curve in that, but maybe for good reason. We'll have to see.
At Davy, we know uncharted territory can be a challenge. We've been in business since 1926, and since then, we've advised many different clients through many global and national crises. Some will seek comfort in the safe and familiar, while others will embrace the opportunity to try something new. Throughout the years, we've not only listened to our clients, we've got to know you personally, helping us advise you on a financial life plan that suits you best. Davy, it's not just business, it's personal. Janie Davy, trading as Davy, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. We take our responsibilities personally.
Chris, what does this tell us about the future? Because there's going to be a lot more state involvement, isn't there, in business, for example, the like of which we couldn't have expected, we couldn't have predicted before the pandemic. The hospitality and the airline industries have been absolutely hammered now, and we've no idea what they're going to look like in 2 or 3 years' time. And there's no doubt, I think, in Britain and in Ireland, there needs to be more investment in public services and particularly in the health sector. So when the dust settles on all of this, how do you think the shakeout will work? What will the retail sector look like, for example?
One of the things that we've learned from economies that have been reopening earlier than Ireland is that demand actually comes back a wee bit quicker than forecasts previously asserted. I mean, we've had it in various continental countries. We've had it in the United States. And then, of course, in the United States, we've got the second wave, or maybe just the continuation of the first, and that dynamic is set up because maybe they reopen too quickly. But when things have reopened, things have come back much quicker than economists have typically forecast, but often in sectors different to the at the sectoral level, it hasn't come back in the same way. Different countries have different experiences of this, and it depends upon consumer behavior. And one of the consequences, I think, one of the contrasts that I paint between what's happened in the UK and Ireland, one of the things that I've noticed, I'm sitting in Ireland at the moment, is that generally people in Ireland are much, much more nervous about going out, about being in a pub, despite all the lurid stories about being in a pub or a restaurant or generally just being out and about, than they are in the UK. There's much more of a cavalier attitude in the UK than it is. People here seem to be much more frightened of this disease than they are in the UK. And I think that will have long-lasting economic effects, because I think that the people going back to retail, people going back to restaurants, people going back to pubs, yes, there was an initial surge in some areas, but I think overall they're going to be very slow. Behaviorally, they're going to be very slow to do it because of fear of this disease. So that's going to have long-lasting consequences. This side of a vaccine or the virus magically disappearing, I personally wouldn't go into a pub or a restaurant. In terms of the data that I've seen, up to 97% of the cases of COVID globally have occurred indoors rather than outdoors. Outdoors is relatively safe. Indoors is the big no-no. And I think that penny is beginning to drop as the data is emerging and scientists are discovering more and more. So if you think about that going indoors comment, particularly into crowded places that are indoors that have poor ventilation, that really speaks for big trouble ahead for places like pubs and restaurants. In the United States, in the Sun Belt, where we know the sun actually contributes to the degrading of this virus. One of the reasons why they've had the upsurge in cases is that they're all locked inside air-conditioned bars and restaurants. And I know one investment bank globally has been using restaurant opening data to predict where COVID is going to flare up 2 weeks hence. It's that correlation is that high. So I think consumer behavior obviously has changed, and I think there's going to be some pretty permanent changes to it going forward as well.
What about offices, Chris? Everybody's talking about remote working, that it's here to stay. And just taking your comments there on being indoors, a lot of people obviously are going to be nervous about being in large offices with large groups of people and air conditioning. You know, some places are good, but some places aren't good. So what's the future of offices and remote working?
Well, ventilation is, I think, going to be a focus on how modern and how well ventilated your offices are, how your filtration system on your air conditioning is going to become a focus for lots of building owners. Ironically, being on an aeroplane is actually quite safe from an air circulation point of view. A lot of the stories that you hear about air travel are myths. Some of them are true, but not all of them. And airlines claim, I think not unreasonably, that their air quality is filtered to surgical operating room standards, and that viruses don't, in fact, travel around the cabin of an aeroplane via the ventilation system. So that's a particular example of good ventilation. We know that lots of offices probably do have varying standards of ventilation. The back to work thing, that's a pendulum that will swing back, but it won't go back to the way it was. I know of at least one chief executive here in Dublin that has businesses in two large buildings, and he's pretty sure that he's only going back to one, for instance. And I think there's going to be a lot of that. Your perspective on whether home working has worked for you varies depending on who you are. If you speak to people like me, it's been fine. I do most of my work from home anyway, and so it hasn't been a big deal for me. And I've enjoyed getting to grips with all of this new technology that we use to do things like this. If you speak to young parents, fathers or mothers or both, who have had young children at home while they've been working from home, you should hear the very graphic descriptions of what it's been like. They have not enjoyed the experience in terms of the people that I have been speaking to. So it depends who you are. A lot of people think that it's been great. Some people are dying to get back to the office.
Owen, the European Commission in its report suggests that a return to growth next year is on the cards. But is that realistic?
The thing about all these growth forecasts, I mean, they all seem to be corralling around the same numbers. I don't think, I'm not sure if your listeners are noticing this, but like the predicted year-on-year fall in Ireland, depending on who you ask, the central bank, the government, now the European Commission, all around 8 or 10%. That's the same in a lot of countries. The predicted fall or the fall in GDP in April, the worst month, was like 25% in a lot of countries. And similarly, the three-month fall is around 20%. So I think what the forecasters are doing, and it's a pretty inexact science, is they're basically just looking at the consumer-facing sectors and you know, cutting them off for the period of time and then extrapolating a figure from that. It's very, very difficult to see where, you know, if those forecasts are going to be exact or if they're even going to be near what they're predicting, you know, because it all comes down to just how fearful the kind of post-lockdown consumer is. And Chris makes an interesting point about people being more fearful here and less fearful in the UK. Those things are going to play out, and nobody really has eyes, you know, on how it's going to work and the level of demand that's going to basically funnel back in and how quickly that level of demand is going to funnel back in to the economy. So, I mean, the central bank last week, if you had noticed, instead of really forecasting, they went into scenarios. So scenario with, you know, a resurgence of the virus and a second wave, or a scenario with no resurgence and no second wave. So they've kind of nearly dumped the forecasting process. So the question you asked about, you know, can we hope for a rebound next year? It's just really in the lap of the gods at the moment.
Chris, there's a couple of important external events taking place this year that will have an impact on Ireland and any recovery. One of them is Brexit. I know you're saying that we shouldn't be calling it that anymore, but for shorthand purposes, let's call it Brexit. There's due to be a deal or not by the end of this year on the future relationship between the EU and the UK. And the other is the American election and whether Donald Trump gets re-elected or not, or Joe Biden gets to go to the White House, and that could have a very significant impact, for example, on global trade. Donald Trump has had trade spats with both the EU and China, for example, in the past couple of years. So Brexit hasn't gone away. It hasn't been talked about much, I guess, in the pandemic, but it looks as if Britain is on course for a no-deal scenario at the minute. Is that your reading of it?
It is. The odds of a no-deal scenario seem to change every day. If you'd asked me this question only last week, this day last week, I'd have said that the mood music coming out of Brussels was actually getting better. And then it suddenly got an awful lot worse again. And that's the way it's going at the moment. Obviously, we're not on the inside of the talks, and there's a lot of saber rattling. There's a lot of jockeying for position because we are at the crunch moment over the next couple of months. One of the things that really scared me was that the most recent round of talks broke up early, which was not a good sign at all. And then all of the rumours and stories and behind the scenes briefings that one gets access to out of Brussels started saying again the two sides are as far apart as ever. And Boris Johnson has only been reported today, for example, as table thumping over a Zoom call, one presumes, with Angela Merkel, saying that they'd be quite happy to go with what's called the Australia solution, which is, you know, so weird. It's almost laughable. The Australia solution isn't a solution. It's the no deal scenario because Australia doesn't have a deal with the EU. For reasons of public relations and media management, they've decided to call it something else other than a no deal because it doesn't sound quite as bad. But this Australia solution that he's threatening Merkel with only today is the no deal. And that would be dreadful for Ireland, of course. It raises all sorts of issues, not least for the agricultural sector. It looks like that Johnson has swallowed the idea of a border in the Irish Sea. One way or another, deal or no deal, there's one coming by the looks of things. For yesterday, for example, they applied to go through the EU process for establishing customs posts in the Northern Ireland ports. So it looks as if that bitter pill has been swallowed. There's a chance of a deal. Yes, absolutely. It's still there. But over the last few days, it's receded.
And Trump versus Biden, which one would be better for Ireland?
Oh, Biden. I mean, there's all sorts of different reasons why one would choose Biden over Trump, and this is nothing personal. I try not to you know, park my own prejudices here, but from what I'm about to say, you'll guess what they are. The world needs another trade war, like it needs a hole in the head. It needs things to be reopened rather than closed down. I think Martin Wolf in the Financial Times yesterday, I know you sometimes carry his pieces in the paper as well. I'm not sure if you've carried this one. It really is a superb piece because it doesn't look at the minutiae of what Trump does and doesn't do in terms of trade wars and multinational taxation and all the other things he gets stuck into. It's at a higher level of discussion, which is that pretty similar to Britain, the United States has shown itself unable to deal with this pandemic in terms of dealing with complexity. The state, the government, simply doesn't work anymore. And as Wolf says, I think it's a very memorable quote, if the state doesn't work, nothing else does as well. And therefore, Trump being re-elected would mean another 4 years of the United States not being a functioning state, which would be a disaster for everybody in the world, not just economically, but politically and socially as well. It's a concern I share for the United Kingdom because the machinery of government is clearly failing when it comes to this pandemic, and the ability to deal with complexity just isn't there. So what we need going forward to deal with A, the pandemic itself, and the incredibly complicated decisions, very difficult choices that are going to face every government post-pandemic, God willing we get there, we need functioning, well-equipped governments, and we certainly ain't got that in the States. And this is the main reason why I would hope for a Biden administration, is that the machinery of government then starts to work again, because it isn't at the moment.
All right, well, I think everybody will probably share that sentiment. Chris Johns and Owen Burke Kennedy, thank you for joining me.
Okay, that's it for this week from Inside Business. My thanks to Chris Johns and Owen Brooke-Kennedy for their contributions. Thanks also to our sponsor, Davey, for their continued support. Declan Conlon produced the show with JJ Vernon as sound engineer. Remember, you can get the latest business news straight into your inbox by signing up to our Business Today email at irishtimes.com. And you can also follow the Irish Times business feed each day on Twitter, LinkedIn and Facebook. I'm Ciarán Hancock. Until next time, take care and stay well.